If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Hi, welcome to Word for Word. I'm your host, Lisa Dano Daniel. Today's guest is a registered psychologist with over 20 years' experience working in the area of mental health. Combining private practice with her role at Queer Space, my guest also manages to find time to be a regular contributor to Melbourne's art scene as a performer and producer. On top of that, she's also mum to two teenagers. Welcome to Word for Word, Ruth Catalaris. So, Ruth, we're chatting today about both of your main careers, which have been in mental health, but also performance. But first, I want to get to know the young Ruth. So let's go right back. Let's situate you in a decade. I don't want to be ageist, but what decade were you born in? Just to give us an idea.
I was born in the 60s.
60s, okay. Yeah. Me too. So we're contemporaries in that way. Tell me about your family. Do you have siblings, your parents? Where did you grow up? That sort of thing.
I am the youngest of five, and I grew up primarily in research out at Eltham. That's not where we started, but we moved out there when I was about nine.
Would that have been quite almost rural in those days?
Totally. So, you know, public transport was almost non-existent, and therefore it was pretty isolating. My childhood wasn't what I would call particularly happy, because my parents were, they struggled a lot in their relationship, but they were also all consumed by it. I went to school, my dad had a barbershop in Northbourne, so that's where I went to school. And going, so we commuted every day to Northbourne and essentially sat in the back of the barbershop, staying quiet, which was not easy for kids or teens to do, until my mum generally arrived around 6 o'clock to take us home.
Yeah, were your parents from the era that didn't divorce, or that you, once you were married, you were just kind of stuck in it, and it was just something you stood up and made vows, and that was your lot in life?
Yeah, look, I think in some ways very much so. There were times when I was a kid I would pray for them to divorce, because they were very violent to each other and to us. It was pretty horrendous. So I would often wish that, particularly my dad, not that he was necessarily the worst. My mother could be incredibly volatile with her tongue, had incredibly rigid standards and was extremely controlling. But between the two of them, he probably got pushed to acting out more, but there was a pecking order, and you know, we were all violent, to be honest. It was kind of what we knew. And so, to go back to your question, on some levels yes, but also there was such a symbiosis, i.e. my mother drove my father. He was in his shop for, I don't know, 40 plus years. Every morning she drove him to work and drove him home. There were a couple of occasions where she let him drive. It wasn't fun either. So, you know, there was an incredible symbiosis about them that it really didn't leave much room for anybody else.
So kind of like a codependence.
Totally.
You said that you were all violent in terms of, I'm reading that as both physically and verbally. Is that, as you say, because it was just what you knew?
Well, it was absolutely what I knew, because it was present in my everyday. My elder two siblings, who were actually of my mother's first marriage, which I understand was also pretty violent, left home when I was really young. So it was primarily the other three of us. And, you know, I learnt to fight because I had two older brothers. And I kind of had to. I also learned to run away.
At what stage of her life did you realise that that wasn't a particularly normal response to emotional stress? Like, you know, did you go to other people's houses in primary school and see that there wasn't that kind of, I'm going to use the word dysfunction, I don't know if that's the right word.
Oh, it's absolutely
chaos,
right.
Maybe?
Well, it's both, actually. I wasn't allowed to go to other people's places, so no. And I fought my way through most of primary school. Probably maybe grade four, I started realising, even in terms of my friendships, like that was always my solution to, you know, a fight with friends was like, you know, let's have a let's have a fist fight, because, you know, my parents usually kind of recovered after they'd, you know, it had got that far.
We're both kind of smiling through this, I know, and it's probably inappropriate, but I'm smiling in particular because you're slightly built, and I'm imagining little Ruth, age 8, flailing fists in the schoolyard. It's amusing, but at the same time disturbing. I get it.
Totally.
And I get it, you know, 60s, 70s was a very different place. So when do you think you realised that wasn't actually how families were operating?
I don't even remember that dawning on me, but I do remember that there was a point in my later primary school that I just stopped kind of behaviour. Mind you, I was also always I was not an easy kid to teach. For the teachers I admired, I was adorable, and you know, a lot of teachers really liked me, and there were teachers who hated me because if I didn't respect the teacher or I didn't think they were particularly, if I didn't feel like they had anything to teach me, I did not respect power for power's sake, if you like.
Where do you think that came from?
Look, I think my parents in their own way were actually independent. You know, I'm painting a really negative picture because that was the torrent, I suppose, that overshadowed a lot of my childhood. But there were things about my parents that were incredibly independent. So my dad came out from Greece when he was 26, 27, after having been shipped away from his home on Kefalonia in Greece at 15. And he spent his early years essentially dodging Italians during the war, taking apart mines and getting the gunpowder out of them. He kind of did his own thing and grew up, you know, he grew up very roughly and saw things that no child should ever have to see. My mum was an only child. She was connected to one very well-known family in Melbourne, but her mother lived in Housing Commission flats. So she was also, you know, in lots of ways struggling, I think, with lots of issues around her sense of self and class and where she fitted in. So, you know, I think they found each other and clinged to each other.
How did they meet?
My mum had a milk bar in Richmond. I don't know what point she started. Like, she was feisty herself, incredibly feisty, very determined and very, very efficient. So she ran milk bars. I don't think that was the first. I think she had one in Mount Albert, I think maybe just before I was born. No, Mount Albert must have been after Richmond. It was a milk bar in Richmond, and he said he walked in one day and she just smiled at him, and it was kind of that. He didn't speak English at the time. His family wasn't happy that he didn't marry a good Greek girl, and her family weren't happy that she married a wog. So, you know, there were external tensions as well. My mum, I think, had been very aware of, you know, the two sides of her world, one that was incredibly wealthy with, you know, doctors and lawyers and judges in the mix. And, you know, I remember going to visit my nana who lived, as I said, in the Housing Commission flats, these great big tall buildings. So she also, finances and money, prestige, I think, were important. She was also a really, they both actually were really smart people too. But neither of them had an education. So I think they were also living with a huge level of frustration about what maybe could have been and was not ever essentially realised for either of them.
Was there Greek spoken at home?
No, because my mum didn't. So, and that kind of further isolated us in lots of ways, because there were other brothers from my dad's family of 8 who kind of came over to Australia as well, and they were cousins, but we couldn't speak to them because my uncles and aunts spoke Greek. And so and there was tension there because my mother was not the typical Greek wife in the 60s. She had an opinion and she was pretty forceful. So, you know, again, we didn't, you know, there were a few friends when we were kids, but they were pretty, you know, few and far between.
So with the conflict in your family, were any of your siblings kind of home to you, or were you sort of all in your separate silos?
Absolutely the latter. It was kind of a very much a divide and conquer. And, you know, that still stands really today.
I was just about to ask. How do you get along now?
Yeah, look, I have a pretty good relationship with my sister, who is 13 years older, and I didn't.
Maybe that's the key, that you didn't really grow up in the same house
No, yeah, absolutely. And I think her impression of me at some point was that I was the spoiled younger child. Well, I didn't feel particularly spoiled. So, you know, there was a discrepancy there. But there have been times in my life where I've really struggled.
You're doing great.
I'm getting emotional. And she's stepped in to support me. And that's been really valuable.
As an adult? So not as a kid. I mean, like you said, you know, she was 13 years older. I'm assuming that she wasn't, you know, as a 13-year-old teenager, she's not really interested in a youngster.
Not at all. And we didn't know each other. Actually, it was around the time, I guess, that I was coming out. There was a period in my maybe really early 20s where I was a mess. It doesn't sound like much, but she let me stay in a block of land that she had. And she just kind of took me up and showed me where it was. There was nothing on it. I stayed there in a tent with a dog. I took a Rottweiler up and a bicycle for cover. So I stayed up there for a while just to give myself some space. And she also actually helped me escape from home. So when I eventually left home, I can't remember whether my parents were out or for some bizarre reason away for the weekend because they didn't go far. She helped me gather my clothes and my mattress and, you know, go to a share house that I'd set up.
So she was obviously aware of how tough things had become for you in that time.
Look, I don't even know. I don't even know how much we talked about it at that point in time, but certainly with the block of land, she was certainly aware. And that was the time I actually came out to her too. There were some interesting questions that she asked me about that, but, you know, I don't need to go into that.
Do your siblings all still live in Melbourne?
No. I haven't seen one of them for about 11 years, though I hear that he is still around. I have contact with my sister, but she lives in the country, about 2.5-3 hours away. And I have one brother who lives at least 1.5 hours away. And then there's myself and another brother.
So you've always had to be pretty self-reliant is what I'm hearing. So pretty resilient, pretty self-reliant. Not, you know, we're not islands, obviously, but
absolutely.
And you know, your siblings your sister has stepped in occasionally. Yeah. Did you all go to the same school?
We did, actually. Not the same primary school, but my sister had been to the same high school just 13 years earlier. We did. And that, you know, that was convenience in lots of ways. So they were kind of local schools that were local to my dad's shop. So we could kind of, you know, be there after school.
What sort of student were you?
A little bit the same as if I liked the subject, I was good. I remember some geography classes sitting up the back with friends singing. I was luckily, I was good at school, so I didn't have to work hard to do well, you know, so that was lucky. I was much more interested in the social aspect of it because I was so isolated at home that it was just, you know, and I wasn't scared at school. I was much more frightened of my family than I was of school. So
was school somewhat of a respite from after school and the home life?
Absolutely. I hated school holidays. Hated them with a passion. So, you know, it was very much my happy place. And, you know, I've always had good friends, you know, even from back then I've always had good friends.
Were you a popular kid at school?
I reckon I would have been in the middle group, you know. I wasn't among the real cool kids. I've always, you know, probably had some friends gravitate towards me. I don't remember times at school being lonely or not having friends.
But you did at home, which is ironic.
It's very different. It was a very, you know, there was no space at home, to be honest. You know, there was no, I mean, I don't think my parents had any idea who any of us really were. You know, there was a time when my mother recognised that I could sing, but that became also kind of more about her in lots of ways.
What do you mean by that?
She would get me to record things. She would tape things, but it was not a pleasant thing for me because I'd sometimes get it wrong and that didn't go down very well.
Did she want to record to show her friends or was it about that?
I don't even know really what her purpose was.
Are your parents still alive?
My dad is. My mum is not.
How do you get along with your dad now?
Yeah, I get along with my dad fine.
Do you think you get to a stage in life when they become a bit vulnerable and you are not vulnerable and that the tables turn a little bit?
Look, I think, you know, I have done a great deal of therapy on my family and I think, you know, I feel very lucky that before my mum died, I was able to get to a place where I was able to talk, to be with her and to help my dad nurse her. And I was with her when she died. My dad and I were with her when she died. It took a lot of work and a lot of, I guess, decisions on my part to do the work by myself, because there was no point trying to engage my family in that or my parents in that. So, you know, that was my own undertaking. So having done that around my mum, my dad and I get along fine. He doesn't ask many questions. I tell him very little about my life, really. I shop for him, I take him to appointments, and the only time, I guess, that we might have a moment is where he starts to wax too lyrical about his relationship with my mother and, you know, our childhood, and I'll just go, stop now. Just don't go any further, and he hears it.
Do you get to a stage where there's really no point in rehashing stuff that you can't change in your past and you just have to sit with it, however you can sit with it, and there's really, like, what would be the point in you sitting him down and saying, these are the issues I had with our upbringing?
None, absolutely none, because, you know, he's 91 and I understand it in a way that I didn't when I was a kid. I guess for me, a lot of it is around recognising who they were and where they came from, which doesn't mean that there wasn't a huge level of grief and fury and rage. I mean, there have certainly been periods where I haven't spoken to my parents. I haven't necessarily told them why. I've just gone, you know, I'm not. And, you know, I said something to my mother when I was in my 20s, when she had a go at me about something, and I just let her know really clearly that it was not okay, that she had no right to comment on anything to do with my life. And I think she got the message then that I did not need them in my life, and that if they were going to be a part of it, it was going to be on my terms. And, you know, having said that, when I decided to have kids, you know, I dealt with that as respectfully as I could, given where they came from in relation to sexuality and all that. And, you know, she was great. They've both been absolutely doting grandparents. I have no complaints. And I think she knew too that that would not be tolerated.
What do you think the gifts were? And I think gifts is probably an interesting word to use, but what do you think the gifts were of your childhood to your parenting? Probably more in line with what not to do.
Completely not what not, you know, what not to do. Much more conscious parenting, which I think is, you know, always important. I think there have been times where I've kind of gone, hang on, stop, you know, I'm feeling threads of, you know, my mum in here, like, what's going on? But yeah, I have a very, you know, huge different relationship. So in terms of the gifts, you know, an awareness, and an awareness about me that I wouldn't have had otherwise, which allows me, I guess, to treat other people very differently. I mean, I live as much of my life consciously as I can, including my parenting, and which is not to say I haven't made mistakes. There have been plenty of those. But I'm also good at apologising, and I'm also, you know, very prepared to listen to my kids when they say that's not, my kids are both very vocal and they're both quite clear about what's okay and what's not, and I listen. I think sometimes, you know, when you parent, there are things that you do because other people suggest it that you look back and just go, that's not what I want to do. You know, even in terms of administering, you know, medicine to a child who doesn't want to take it, you know, like, there were times that out of, I think, a fear response as a parent, you do that. And I look back and just go, why? Why was I not listening much more to what my child was actually needing at the time rather than listening? My son in particular has always been somebody that when he's been sick, he will not eat, he will not drink, he just burns with a fever. And then 24 hours later, it's gone. And, you know, so learning to trust his instincts and his body and what he needs has been a, you know,
Your kids are now late teens, yeah?
One's 20, one's 17. Oh, wow. Doesn't time fly?
Yeah, that's incredible. Now, let's circle back to sexuality, because, of course, we are on a GLBTIQA+ radio station. When did you start to feel like your sexuality or your interest in other humans wasn't like those around you?
Very clearly around 13, I reckon, 12, 13. Maybe some inklings before that because I attached very strongly when I attached. In fact, nothing's probably changed from that in lots of ways. But, you know, I was getting lots of crushes on TV actors, actresses.
Susie Quattro for me.
Oh, really? Yep. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I don't even think I want to confess mine.
Come on.
Angie Dickinson, policewoman.
Oh, yes, I can totally see that.
Penny Hackforth-Jones in Tandara.
Yep.
And again, all strong, independent women.
PE teacher for me too.
My English teachers for me.
A couple of English teachers, if you're listening, hello.
Yeah, one French teacher.
And did that realisation feel like it was a positive thing or it was a mystery or, you know, what were your thoughts around not being attracted to boys in the same way that you liked girls?
I had actually, at 15, I'd started dabbling with boys just because I was curious about relationships. And so I think I'd probably gone along the way of most kind of teenage girls and got all giggly and silly about, you know, and writing, you know, boys' names on my folder. I was probably, apart from the crushes, I was kind of a little bit oblivious probably until I was about, because I actually do not know that I don't remember knowing that there was an alternative. Like, I don't think it ever dawned on me. I remember at primary school once, one of my friends was saying goodbye to me for the holidays and she was teary and I kissed her and this kid yelled out, "Lesbian!" Of course. And I went home and said to my mother, "What's a lesbian?" And she said, as she was wont to do, "Look it up in the dictionary," which I think I probably did, but I don't know that anything sunk in from that either. Definitely around, you know, 16 to 17, I was aware of the feelings stirring and it was never a problem for me. I was just like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I knew it wasn't something. I remember standing around a group of kids and I think it was probably I was in year form 11 or 12. I'm going back to VCE days. And they were talking about an episode of Prisoner, Peter Tapano and the character who played Frankie, was it? Yeah.
Yep.
Armstrong.
Frankie, yep.
And I'd watched it. You know, there was this moment where it looked like they were about to kiss. And all the girls around were standing around going, yuck, yuck. And I just stood there silently going, yeah, well, I'd actually really wanted that to happen. I was aware at that point that I was different. And it was, I think I've always been relatively lucky at listening to what I felt and just kind of going, you know, just kind of on some levels honouring it. Not always. There's certainly been some things I've wrestled with hugely, but in terms of sexuality, it was just very much like, that's what I feel. And my first girlfriend was 17, at 17, and I remember saying to her, we'd got very, very close, and I remember saying to her something about, I'm feeling something for you, and she went, yeah, I know, don't worry about it. And I think we were at a bar one night, and she kind of just, you know, dragged me into the toilets and just went, it's fine. And we talked about it later that night, and then kind of, you know, things went from there. I just knew that I couldn't talk about it. My parents particularly made their feelings about homosexuality very, very clear.
So just in terms of general stuff at home, like comments on, you know, things in front of the TV, often when I speak to people in here, A, they first saw something that sparked a recognition via TV, film,
yeah,
a magazine they've picked up. And the other side of the coin is that they picked up from their parents. You know, they might have been watching Number 96 and the character of Arnold and, you know, dad's gone, oh, that's disgusting. And so, you know, a young gay boy goes, oh, okay, well, that's, I feel like that's me. And so...
Totally.
That's sort of where we get the message from.
So absolutely.
It's an interminable loop of shame and feeling like an outsider. So it sounds like you were sort of mid-teens when you sort of realised it yourself. But at what age were you when you sort of actually started coming out and coming, you know, came out to your family and friends? I'm assuming it was friends first.
Oh, absolutely. So for a while it was just, her name was Kathy. It was just Kathy and me. And then I had been kind of virtually living at a theatre group around where I lived from about 15 to 20, and I started telling a couple of people there maybe. I never formally came out to my family, my parents anyway. I said something to my mother one day about being, because that was the other, sorry, I'm backtracking, but that was the other issue for me too. Like, I had two lesbian images in my head when I was 17, 18. One was Frankie from Prisoner, and the other was the Queen and Barbarella. Do you remember?
Oh, yes.
You know, pretty.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they were
two very different images.
Two very different. And I just kind of went, I looked at me and went, I'm not quite sure where I fit. If that's, and you know, this was this kind of stereotype. And so it took me a little while trying to work out, because I was still kind of, around 18, 19, I was kind of jumping out of bed with one person and, you know, a boyfriend at the time, and then going and jump into bed with, you know, my girlfriend. And so I was kind of not quite sure where I sat, and it took a little while. So probably maybe when I was about 20, 21, I went to a conference that was held in Melbourne, a queer conference, and I just kind of looked at everybody and went, okay, that's fine. I fit somewhere in here, because they were all different shapes and sizes, and it wasn't an issue. But the push to not be bisexual was also incredibly strong in those days. And I don't think that's truly who I am, but I certainly was at the time. In terms of coming out, I said to my mother something about being bisexual, and I can remember verbatim exactly what she said, which was, "You're young, you're immature, you don't know what you're talking about, and if you love your father and I, you'll forget all about it." Well,
a pretty powerful message.
Yeah, and I clearly didn't forget all about it, but I just didn't speak to them about it again, ever really, until my dad said something to me maybe 6 or 7 years ago about the fact that my lifestyle choice was difficult for them. I've had a few things to say about that. Having said that, I didn't hide also my sexuality. So if I wanted to bring somebody home, I did that. Not while I was living there. Actually, no, my girlfriend actually did stay quite a lot. I had a lock on my door and it was okay. I don't think my mother at that point kind of necessarily realised that there was anything potentially going on. As I got older and, you know, I would take a partner home to visit if I felt like it, if there was something going on and I needed cover, I'd take a girlfriend with me. To their credit, so I lost a partner in my late 20s. To their credit, they sat with me through a very open queer funeral and said nothing. And just, I mean, they knew by that stage. They certainly knew, you know, they weren't that stupid. And they just didn't comment. And, you know, they offered me what support they could at that time.
Do you think that was their way of giving tacit approval, or do you think it was just too hard for them to talk about?
My family didn't talk about anything. So I learnt the facts of life by going to one of those films. I reckon, one night of my entire childhood that my mother was sick and for some strange reason couldn't come.
One of those things at the council?
I think it might have been held by the primary school, but actually that's not true. My brother told me about the facts of life before that, but, you know, this was the official. My family did not talk. They did not talk about anything. They did not talk about feelings. They screamed and yelled and made lots of demands, but they did not talk about anything. So there's no way that either of them would have brought it up.
Hi, you're listening to Word for Word, and I'm chatting to Ruth Catarellis. Let's circle back to high school, and I want to get to performance.
Yeah,
because I feel like there's a link here. The fact that you were drawn to performance might have something to do with the way you were brought up, I guess. When you were in high school, did you want to be a performer? Was that the aim? Like, did you have any other, like, plan B? Like, I want to work in banks or something? Or was it just,
I want to
work as a performer?
I honestly don't think I had even thought about what was possible. I don't think I ever thought that acting was possible as a profession. I didn't have, you know, my parents were not into the arts. I had never seen, until I went to, made my way down to, it was called Eltham Little Theatre at the time, at about 15, 16, I had never seen a live show. They didn't really, they put the radio on in the car on the way, so I'd listen to a bit of music, so I knew a bit about music, but beyond that, movies and films were my thing.
And was that a revelation at 15, seeing a live theatre?
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, I'd done little play stuff at primary school, and I'd always been interested in words and language. I loved reading. Was a huge escape for me. I learnt to read really early. I mean, that was another one that, you know, my mother's ego really needed us to learn to read early, and we complied. But books were a huge escape for me, books and movies, when I was allowed to have the TV on. So it absolutely was. And there was something about There was something about the music and the emotion of it that I just, you know, was, you know, I loved absolutely. And it was, you know, liberating, hugely liberating.
What do you think it was about your self-confidence that allowed you to think that you could do that, that you could perform in public in front of people, given your background?
You know, that's always kind of come in fits and starts, I have to say. So I struggled early primary school. I'd go along and I sang at primary school. I had teachers who encouraged me musically, and I had one teacher who would often get me to stand up in front of the class and sing. And at that point, I could do it until something happened and I got words wrong or I stuffed up and there was a reaction from the class, and then I went back into my shell for a while. At secondary school, I always auditioned for the plays, school plays, and I generally got parts, which kind of got progressively bigger as I got higher in the school. But to start with, I couldn't sing by myself. That confidence grew as I kind of became more comfortable. And I've kind of always been a little bit like that in a group. I'm relatively reticent to start with until, you know, I get a bit more comfortable and then I kind of, you know, emerge a bit.
Like a flower.
Something like that.
So what were you aiming for towards the end of school?
Nothing. My parents insisted that I had to finish. I didn't want to. I wasn't loving it. I liked the social aspect. Had a couple of teachers, one in particular that I clashed with. There were other teachers I loved, but I wasn't, you know, my head wasn't there. But they insisted that I do it. And I wasn't going to put anything on my form at the end of what are you going to do after. I had no idea what I was going to do. And I was pushed by my teachers to go, you know, you must. So I put down Rusden Drama, Rusden English, and that was it.
Which is now Victoria College.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, so that's where I went. And that was kind of like I went because it was easier than thinking. And, you know, the opportunity to actually do classes in drama and dance was, you know, fantastic. But it was difficult for me to look beyond just trying to get through, really.
Were you able to work and earn a living performing during your student days?
Not to start with. So I trained. I actually went into teaching to start with because it was easier route. Yeah, my first teaching placement I didn't love. It was in Northcote Tech, which in the old days was, you know, incredibly, it was rough. It was really rough. And it was between these kind of, you know, big, you know, beefy boys, and as you said before, I'm not big either. Big beefy boys who kind of wanted to stand over you, or some of them who'd look at you with these great big kind of eyes, and I just didn't want a part of either of it. So then I got invited to try out to do a session at a girls' school, and I jumped. And so I taught there for, I probably only lasted about a year, maybe 18 months, and just went, this is not what I want to do. So at that point, I quit and I walked straight into a job in theatre and education. That kept me going for a while, which was great. At that point, I was earning a wage.
So what led you to study psychology?
Well, at that first teaching job, I met a woman who was an amazing woman.
So what age are we talking? So early 20s?
Yeah, I reckon I was about 23. I'd had a really messy kind of late teens. I'd been into alcohol and drugs and kind of, you know, partying pretty hard, and essentially felt like I was crazy. So, you know, that wasn't fun. But I got this job at this school, and I met a woman who was going to become an incredibly important part of my life. She was about 13 years older than me, an English teacher, probably one of the best minds I think I've ever encountered.
So she became your partner?
Yes.
Were you both teaching at the same school or just in the same industry?
We were teaching at the same school. I had already been there, and I remember I was standing in getting a cup of tea one day, and this woman walked in the door, and I looked up and she looked at me, and we just smiled at each other, and it wasn't kind of instant. There was certainly a recognition. Yeah, so we became partners.
Did the school know? Was that, like, in those days, was that something that wasn't the done thing?
The school certainly caught on. Some members of the school staff certainly caught on relatively quickly. It was a great staff. Things were pretty relaxed, but I think a few of them, you know, we'd go down and have drinks. You know, it was water for me in those days. But I'd go along to the pub just to kind of be a bit social. And I think that, you know, some of the staff kind of watched it happening. We were very trying to be very discreet, you know, to start with. We'd follow each other in our different, you know, respective cars to work. Yeah, so we became an item and we started living together. We started living together maybe, I don't know, 18 months after that. Maybe it was sooner, I don't know. Time is such a, you know, it's a bit foggy for me. And then it wasn't that long after that I decided that I wanted to actually leave teaching. So, yeah, Helen and I were together for 5.5 years before she passed away very suddenly.
Mind if I ask what happened to Helen?
And she had an aneurysm, so it all happened in the space of a day. I wasn't working full-time then, so I was still CRTing at the emergency teaching, we called it in those days, at that school. We had bought a house together in Coburg. I remember that morning vaguely. You know, we had a menagerie. We had 3 dogs and about, I don't know, at the time, about 7 cats, I think, including a little white ghost cat that had just recently come into our lives about a month before she passed away. So I remember her picking, and Ebony would kind of sleep under the covers with me. And so I remember, you know, this vague recollection of her, you know, coming in and taking the kitten for breakfast. And then there was a phone call that awoke me about, I don't know, maybe it was around, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock, to say that she'd collapsed at school and was there anything they should know? And I just kind of went, call an ambulance. They did that. I went to the hospital that she was taken and I waited. I probably had about 5 minutes with her during the course of that day. She wasn't conscious at all.
Did they acknowledge you was her partner?
Yeah. I didn't have any issue. I mean, they asked me. Because she was a bit older than me and because I have always looked younger than my years, you know, the first question was, is she your mother? Which always used to piss her off, understandably. But it was like, no, she's my partner. There was no question. There was nobody gave me any indication that I wasn't the person that they should be speaking to, which was great. So, yeah, essentially by about, you know, 3 o'clock that afternoon, they, maybe it was a little bit later because a couple of teachers came over after school to see what was happening and she'd gone, essentially.
I can't imagine the ripping of life that you thought you had and the future that you thought you had just like in a matter of seconds just coming under. I can't even imagine it. I really can't. I've lost grandparents, but I haven't lost a partner or a parent even. I haven't lost anyone. I haven't lost friends that are close to me. So I can't imagine that sudden. For me, it must be like, can we just rewind 10 minutes or 3 hours or whatever and this not happen? I mean, what do you do after something like that, in the hours after?
I'll look at, you know, I mean, I'm wiping away the tears now, but, you know, it was devastating. It was absolutely. It was not. In the preceding 2 years before Helen died, I'd lost 3 other people close to me. My best friend by suicide, in a friend who had been living in our house with us by suicide, and a little girl who was the daughter of some very close friends who I had developed a really strong connection with. And that was in the period of kind of 1990. Helen and I had gone overseas and we arrived back to the first person's funeral. And then Helen died in 1992. So it felt like it was just this roller coaster of, you know, grief and loss. And then, well, then with Helen dying, it was just, I mean, I was floored, really.
Is that what led you to psychology?
Absolutely. I mean, I literally, like, I mean, I pretty well went to bed. Work dried up. I think it was too hard. Like, it was too hard to have me at the school that we worked at. And there was also, like, in terms of the students, I don't actually believe in coincidence at all. In some of the days prior to her passing, Helen had been having conversations with her students, and because we'd both been through all these deaths together, and she'd been having students conversations because they were doing some literature book that it, you know, revolved around death, and she'd said something about, if you ever, you know, get the chance to touch a dead body, I don't know why she said that, but she did. She said, do. And literally, you know, two or three days later, she was gone. So her funeral was this cavalcade of students, essentially kind of, you know, going past her funeral. Like, they closed the school for the day. And, you know, it was, she was hugely loved because she was, you know, she would absolutely walk. Like, she was, you know, boisterous. You know, she'd walk into a room, very, very different to me in lots of ways in those days, because I was really quite shy and quiet, unless I was, you know, back me into a corner, I'd come out fighting. But I didn't, if I wasn't needing to fight, then I was pretty quiet. And she would just occupy a space. So there was this huge funeral, lots of kids coming past. But I think subsequent to that, I think it was actually hard to have me around the school.
And surely hard to be there.
Yeah, totally. And but I just, you know, I was kind of in my, you know, normal state in lots of ways of just get up and just keep going, just kind of roll on, which is, except, you know, crying at the same time, because that's not something I've ever been able to stop. So work pretty well dried up for me. So I literally went to bed for 6 months. I read lots of Agatha Christie. And I looked after the animals, and I worked in a couple of other places, just kind of disappeared a bit. And, you know, had a couple of friendships, but friendships were really hard because people don't know how to deal with grief. So
we're terrible at it in Western culture, don't you think?
Absolutely shocking. And so people would kind of not talk about it, which was just impossible because she just, you know, consumed every waking thought, really.
I spoke to Dennis Altman in here recently, whose partner died in 2012, and they'd been together for, it was like 25 years, I think.
Yeah.
And he said he would like to bring the morning suit back, you know, so that you could be out in public, you know, like, I guess like your Greek ancestors who would wear black for the rest of their lives if their husbands died or whatever.
Totally.
And I think the Jewish religion also does some really structured things around timing and, you know, how long you grieve for. He was sort of calling for... He was sort of half-joking, but, you know, it made a lot of sense that you want to be out in public saying, you know, I need to be held by friends and strangers because I'm grieving. And he said that he cried every single day for about 18 months, and then he woke up one morning and he sort of made a conscious decision to stop being in that level of grief and just move to a different aspect of grief. Can you relate to any of that?
Yeah, completely about the stuff about, because it's something that completely and totally changes who you are in that moment. So having some kind of, you know, sign, I mean, I understand the armbands, and I also understood the gnashing of teeth and, you know, like, and the keening and the wailing, because, you know, it is a fundamental, I suppose it's like what you said before, it's a fundamental severing.
Well, it changes the course of your life. It changes...
Absolutely.
Not only your future that you thought you had, but it changes who you are as a person. When you're in a relationship with someone, I don't believe in all this stuff about, you know, when you marry someone, you become one. I think that's bullshit. But certainly when you're in a partnership, there is an aspect of teamwork that you don't have with your friends. And if it's severed so suddenly like that, without warning, it must be incredible to sort of rebuild your sense of self and get back out into the world.
It was incredibly hard. And I think the other thing for me was I felt like Helen was probably the first person in my life who actually saw me and who actually valued me for more than, you know, like when we got together because of, you know, my age and her age, you know, a couple of her friends gave her a bit of a hard time, you know. It's this cute young thing, you know, on her arm. But, you know, I didn't feel like that at all. There was no sense of inequality. There was a lot of... She absolutely saw who I was.
And that's a really rare thing too. I don't think we don't meet many people in our lives that see us, warts and all, the daggy phrase. But, A, we don't let people in that easily. When we do, there's just not many people that we meet that we can feel safe like that with. So the sense of grief must be extraordinary.
Yeah, look, it was absolutely monumental. And you know, again, I've worked through a lot of it, but there are certainly times, you know, I wrote a couple of songs afterwards that I still can't sing on stage. Again, I'm going back to your question. I literally needed a reason to get out of bed. Got myself an agent before, and I was getting, you know, starting to get auditions and a few gigs, but I just could not go along to a casting and smile and pretend that my world hadn't, you know, fallen apart, essentially. I just went, okay, what? And I went, well, okay, acting, psychology, you know, human emotions, which has always, always been my thing. You know, as an actor, it's a much safer way to get into, you know, exploring emotions rather than just sitting ones with one's own. And I've got five planets in Scorpio. There's a lot of water in my chart. And so, you know, emotions have always been there. So I kind of went, yeah, okay. I went back, I did my undergraduate psych, then I did my fourth year, and then I did my master's.
I can see the links between performance and psych with what you just said in terms of being able to access emotions but of your own, but also understand others, the emotions of others, and help them unpack.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you asked me before a question about gifts around my childhood, and I will often be sitting with a client and just kind of go, you know, I know this. My capacity for empathy is, you know, pretty strong because, you know, my life's been a pretty big journey on occasions. It's not hard for me, and I'm also not scared of emotion, so it's not hard for me to sit with somebody else's and to be present in that. So it felt like the absolute made huge sense. And it also has, in the following years, it's also allowed me a huge level of flexibility with my acting and performing work too, because I just went straight into private practice, essentially.
Here's a really cynical question. Having a background in performance, well, you know, it's not a background, you do it now. Does that help you with clients that you find it hard to gel with in terms of having to, I don't mean like acting as if you're concerned, but does it help to be able to be empathetic even when you don't really feel it, if you have access to that performative?
You know, I've never even thought about that. Like, it's not something I ever think about accessing. You know, they're very different spaces, I guess, to occupy. When I'm with a client, you know, even if it's somebody that I had struggled to gel with, I just listen a lot more, to be honest. You know, I just kind of step back and certainly watch what my face is doing if I'm struggling a little bit with what's being said. But, you know, generally it's just, you know, I just go maybe a little bit more slowly, whereas, you know, performance is just a completely different, it's just a different thing.
And have those two aspects of your life helped with parenting and helped with so let's reverse a little bit. You had two kids with your previous partner,
yeah.
Marg. You didn't stay together,
no,
in a relationship sense, but you did stay together living in the same home.
We did.
Talk me through that.
I feel like I have to go back. So some years after Helen died, you know, there were a couple of relationships in between. Then I decided again I needed some friends in my life. So I joined a choir, MGLC. I joined, and so I met Marg there. We got together. Children had been in my mind after the period of loss that I'd experienced. I just kind of went, I've done death. I actually feel like I need to experience the other side. And so I'd already started this journey before I met Marg. I'd found a donor and I'd had one miscarriage. And then Marg got on board, you know, not completely comfortably necessarily. It wasn't something that she'd envisaged for her life path, but it was, this is kind of where the train's going, and so you can either stay on board or you can jump off. She decided to stay on board, and then I found another donor. A couple of other miscarriages, two children. We you know, we've had our ups and downs. Obviously, we had our ups and downs. We had some great times together. We travelled brilliantly together. Yeah, she was incredibly solid in terms of bringing my two kids, Joel and Maddie, in. And then I think, to be honest, I think that for me, giving out to two kids and giving out in my work, I just felt like I needed more space for me, and so felt like that part of our relationship for me had run its course. It was not an easy transition at moments, which, you know, God, ending a relationship never is it?
Nope.
But then, you know, we managed to co-parent and live together for another 10 or so years, and then we only finally actually went our own way. We sold the house that we'd been living in, and we both bought in Preston within, you know, 3 minutes walk of each other, so that the kids could have easy access. So
it's a very modern situation. It seems to work. Like, it sounds like the friendship has been the thing that's carried you through.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we still have our moments, and I think, but again, that's, I think, you know, after having known somebody for that long, you sometimes, you kind of can fall into habits of behaving or responding to each other that aren't always positive. And so, you know, we try and work on that stuff. It's been good for the kids. They both have a permanent base with me. My daughter was going to spend more time with Marg, which she did last year during, you know, lockdown and the footy. Marg will watch the footy with her. I'm not so keen. But, you know, they move relatively freely between the two houses. And, you know, we will catch up at least once or twice a week, all of us, for dinner. And we still, you know, we still have friends in common. I think it was a huge relief to our friendship circle who went, oh, my God, you know, Ruth and Marg are separating. What are we going to do? And we kind of went, you know, just invite us both.
Yeah, I think leave it to other people and you can decide.
Exactly. And, you know, no drama. We still have, you know, some couples that we only catch up with together, and we have our own friends as well, obviously.
So what does the future hold for you? I know you work at Queer Space and you have a private practice.
Yeah.
How important is Queer Space? Tell me a little bit about Queer Space. What is it?
Sure. Queer Space is amazing. So Queer Space is part of Drummond Street Family Services, which has got locations in Carlton, in Coburg, in Epping. Now there's a Queer Space in Geelong. Queer Space provides... Look, I started working there about 3.5 years ago. Essentially, we deal with any clients from, you know, within the queer community or some who are just entering it or finding it. It's been an amazing team and it's been a fantastic journey for me. There's been a lot of learning in it. I got incredibly busy during COVID in terms of my private practice, and so I've just dropped one of my days there, but I'm not yet ready to leave. There's a real open-heartedness there. There's a real... One of the things that I've loved about the team is that, you know, working with a team, and it's grown since I've been there, it was led by an amazing woman who has unfortunately just left. But it was a team there where ego was not an issue. It was just a really open place to explore, you know, what our clients were bringing, explore, you know, any issues that the queer community was facing. It's run by, you know, a pretty amazing CEO as well, who's, you know, got a finger in lots of pies within the community. You know, incredible place to be a part of, really.
What sort of effects have you seen during COVID the last 12 months?
Yeah, look, it's been a real mix. You know, for some clients, the lockdown was easier because there were less expectations on them. The income that they were receiving if they were on benefits went up, which was wonderful. So they actually, you know, for the first time could survive and actually maybe buy a few things. So for some clients, it worked okay. As time grew on, that shifted. Clearly, for clients who were in either share houses that were difficult or in relationships that were difficult, that was really hard. There was certainly an increase in, you know, family and interpartner violence that we saw. We saw some increases, you know, obviously in anxiety. So it just, you know, it was a little bit of a roller coaster throughout the duration of it, I guess. I think the recent lockdown, I know, has, you know, even though it was only short, has hit some of my clients hard. It was just...
And I'm assuming there was no performance during the last 12 months. So are you looking forward to getting back into... Because you're producing as well.
Yeah.
Are you looking forward to getting back to using that muscle again?
I'm very much looking forward to it. Look, I did do a couple of things over COVID. Like, there was one director that I work with who was doing some Zoom stuff, and I did a little bit of writing. But, you know, doing stuff over is not my fun thing.
An audience is such a part of performing, surely.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I am looking forward to it. I have got, there's a show that I was going to be doing at last year's Comedy Festival at La Mama, which is going to be now at this one, called Mrs. Robinson, which should be fun. It's, you know, camp and crazy, and I've got some stuff coming up during Midsummer Maud. Davey and I are doing our jazz, Goddesses of Jazz show, doing a couple of performances at Chapel Off Chapel for Midsummer, so that's going to be exciting. But yeah, it's just really nice, and I went to see something last night, you know, like, it's just lovely to actually kind of feel like, you know, the arts are starting up again.
Yeah, mingling with other humans and seeing something with an audience.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can't replace it.
It's wonderful.
Well, Ruth, you have had a lot of challenges, but you've also had a lot of victories, a lot of gifts from your childhood. I know that's probably whitewashing, you know, the things you went through, but I can see that you've you seem to have settled into a really amazing space of helping people in terms of their mental health, but also performance and using that part of your brain and your body. And I look forward to seeing what you do next. And, you know, thanks for everything you do for people and their mental health as well. And thanks for being so open and honest with me.
Thank you, Lisa. I mean, I just want to say I have a strong belief in the human spirit. You know, my spirituality is incredibly important to me, nothing to do with religion. But I think, you know, being able to support people to kind of be the best version of whoever they want to be, you know, is an incredible privilege. So, you know, and, you know, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for the chat. Thanks, Ruth. This episode is now available for download as a podcast. You can find this episode and the entire back catalogue of Word for Word episodes across the seasons on iTunes and Spotify, or download directly from the Joy website, joy.org.au. While you're at it, head over to the Word for Word Facebook page to keep up to date with news and episodes. Joy Podcasts, where you want them, when you want them.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.